Hello and welcome to this week's A Photographic Life. There are going to be times when we can't wait for somebody. Now, you're either on the bus or you're off the bus. If you're on the bus and you get left behind, then you'll find it again. If you're off the bus in the first place, then it won't make a damn. American novelist, essayist and countercultural figure Ken Kesey said that. Seemed particularly relevant to me this week because I was giving a talk to a school of journalism recently at a university, and one of the questions that came up, which quite often comes up actually when I'm in conversation with people, is how on earth do I come up with stuff to talk about every week on the podcast and to write about at UnitedNationsOfPhotography.com? Well, for me, it's quite straightforward, and I'm going to use a metaphor for this. I suppose, in a way, you could call it the glass of milk theory. I don't know if I got this from someone else. I probably did. I certainly didn't make it up, I don't think. Anyway, the idea is that all of us are born with a big glass of milk next to us. Now, let's call that glass of milk creativity, or we might call it inspiration. Through our lives, through our schooling, through our education, through our photographic work, we return to that glass for a little sip. And as we go through that glass and we kind of return to it again and again and again, it gradually empties until we get to a point where it is completely empty and there is no milk left. Of course, what we need to do is keep topping that glass up as we go along. And the way we do that is by getting engaged with things that are happening around us. Reading books, magazines, website articles, watching YouTube videos, television, film, listening to the radio, podcasts, talking with friends, with colleagues, with families. Talking with people who we don't agree with people we don't understand. Listening to people who are our friends, who give us positive advice and boost our confidence, perhaps. So there's a whole range there of ways in which we can top up that glass of milk. I suppose in a way, in a dry academic sense, you could call all of this research. But so often people feel that research has to be this thing that happens in libraries, in books you don't really want to read. I don't believe that. I believe that our life in itself is research. So when I put this podcast together, it is a mixture of all of those things. So you get an idea, really, I suppose, of what I've been looking at over the last week or couple of weeks. Or sometimes I might go further back. But I know that if I didn't do that and my glass of milk was empty, I really wouldn't have very much to say. I wouldn't have very much to work on. My projects wouldn't exist. So I suppose this week's episode begins with a piece of advice. Make sure you've always got a glass of milk on hand. This week, I'm pleased to welcome to the podcast Carl McDougall, who is a documentary photographer from Ontario, Canada, who is currently residing in the United Kingdom, and whose work is driven by a fascination with rural environments, quiet spaces, history and time. After graduating from film school in the early 2000s, Carl spent the first 10 years of his career working as a cinematographer and director in the television industry, as well as running a commercial video production company. In 2017, he and his wife sold their house, left their jobs, and took off on a year-long road trip across North Africa, which ultimately inspired a new creative direction in his career. His focus has now shifted towards pursuing long-term photography projects and sharing creative and educational content through his YouTube channel. His first book, titled An American Mile, is a culmination of 5 years spent exploring and documenting small towns in the American Southwest. And he's currently working on two projects. One documenting the slate landscapes of North Wales and the other focusing on the history of the Royal Air Force in World War II and its lost airfields. Oh, I should have said at the beginning. He's going to tell us what photography means to him. But you know that, don't you?
So what does photography mean to me? This is something that I can say with certainty has changed throughout, I guess, my entire career as a photographer, multiple times, doing this for just about 20 years now. And I think at the start, you know, if I had to kind of look back, photography at that point probably meant to me, or at least I thought it mostly was about self-expression. So just going and creating the work and the actual individual images themselves and trying to capture something that no one else had captured before, a specific moment in a specific time, and just make something unique as an expression of I guess, myself and my interests, and maybe as time went on, even deeper than that, linking it to potentially, you know, how I was feeling in specific moods and specific thoughts and things like that. But, you know, if I were to kind of fast forward to where I'm at now and think about what it means to me and what it's always meant to me, I think at the kind of forefront, photography is almost like this vehicle for discovery for me. And it's one of the things that I enjoy the most about it. So it's still, yes, about the work and about the specific subject and story and history and these things that I'm trying to document and create. It's still about self-expression. But, you know, one of the things that is so important to me now is the influence that being a photographer has on me, and the places it makes me go, the people it makes me meet, the situations that it puts me in, the way that it, you know, forces me to look at environments and look at the world in a way that I just wouldn't otherwise. And I've always thought about this a little bit. It has always been something that's appealed to me, but I think, you know, at this point, I'm really starting to recognize how kind of significant that is and how important it is for me. Just even sometimes being out, you know, say 10 kilometers out in the landscape by myself at a certain time of day in awful weather, just a place that I would never be if it weren't for having a camera and wanting to go and document something and just having this incredible experience, this kind of one of a kind experience that I wouldn't have otherwise. Or it could also be, you know, driving through small towns, down these back roads and, you know, pulling up to people's houses and knocking on doors when I see something interesting and going into those people's environments and having conversations with them and getting to know about them. Just again, something that I wouldn't be doing if I weren't looking to make images and work on these specific projects. An example is just a couple weeks ago, I did about 1,000 miles across the UK working on a kind of a new idea that I'm toying with a little bit. And I pulled up to one house that had some interesting things outside, and I ended up meeting the owner and he took me through the house and we had just these really great conversations. And over the course of that trip, that happened, similar kind of scenarios happened multiple times. And I ended up having, you know, 4 or 5 different situations where I had these, you know, really great conversations and connections with other people. So I think as I get older and the longer I do this, that is one of the most enjoyable, rewarding, exciting parts for me, is just how photography influences me to go out and experience the world. Essentially, just again, the places I go, the situations I end up in, the people I meet, it's really about kind of discovery and learning and understanding. So yeah, that, if I had to pick one thing, would probably at this point be at the forefront. Like I said, it's still about self-expression. It's still about capturing things that interest me. You know, nowadays it's even about taking on a little bit more of like a historical standpoint with some of my work and capturing things that are, I think, at least to me, important to document while they're still here. But yeah, discovery, self-expression, engagement with others, and just the way that it allows me to experience the world.
Thank you, Carl, for your contribution this week. It seems to me as if Carl's using travel to fill up his glass of milk. I think maybe that's the end of the metaphor for this week, but I think you know what I mean. Well, anyway, check him out. Check out his work. As always, I know you won't be disappointed. As I said from the beginning of this episode, or at the beginning of this episode, I should say, I get my inspiration from all sorts of different places. And one of them, of course, which I think many of you look at for photographic inspiration, is, of course, Instagram. Not quite sure how it's all working out for you at the moment. I'm seeing a lot of discontent around Instagram at the minute from photographers. But anyway, it's not a platform I use a lot, certainly not for photographic inspiration. However, roughly a year ago, March 2023, a very good friend of mine who's on Instagram, art director Jeff Waring, who's previously contributed to this podcast, he put up a little post to say that Condé Nast were leaving Vogue House, the home of Condé Nast in London in the UK. Now, Bill Shapiro and I have been talking about the death of editorial photography in our conversation over the last few months, and you seem to really be enjoying it. An incredible amount of feedback around those episodes. There's still one more to go. We thought it would just be one episode, then it became two, and now it's going to be three. Anyway, what also came out of that post from Jeff was I noticed that underneath, a lot of people who had worked there or passed through the building started to share their ideas, their memories, their experiences of being in that building. And it made me think there's a book there. So I contacted a publisher, spoke about it, and they said, yeah, let's do it. And I said, yeah, but if we do this book, it's got to come out in just a year because Condé Nast were leaving the building this February 2024, and I want the book to come out as soon after as possible. Well, in a week's time, on April 25th, Thursday, Hatchards, Piccadilly in London, is the book launch. I'll be there signing copies. If you can come along, that would be great. Love to see you there if you can make it. But I thought I'd just read, for those of you that won't be able to make it, a kind of abridged, truncated version of the introduction with a couple of stories from the book that I will be reading at the launch as part of the event. Anyway, so the book is called Inside Vogue House, One Building, Seven Magazines, 60 Years of Stories, and it's published by Orphans Publishing, and it's available now. I first stepped into Vogue House in 1991. I can't recall which month it was, but it was warm and sunny. In those days, the reception was not in the main foyer, but on one of the floors above, and therefore part of the inner sanctum. A visitor like me had two choices to reach it. You could go via the central, wide, solid, white stone staircase, reminiscent of ascending to the balcony of a 1930s Odeon cinema, or you could choose one of the two copper-doored original 1950s lifts, designed for a human fed on a diet of post-war rationing. I chose the stairs. These led to a dark, windowless, wood-panelled corridor that reminded me of a gentleman's club or a rather faded country hotel. Two men, the Peters, in dark blue uniforms and white shirts, sat behind a desk, further confirming the feeling of a private club. I took a seat on one of the chairs that ran along the corridor and waited to be interviewed by the editor of Tatler. The rest, as they say, is history. My time on Tatler is often described by those who were there as the Diana days. I've also heard them described as the golden days of the magazine, and I can understand why. The 1990s in Vogue House were a wild and wonderful ride, controversial, high energy, and high impact. The building was filled with an incredible collection of talented people, many of whom just beginning their careers. Others well-established and intimidating, and some who were coming to the end of their relationship with publishing and magazines. It was a melting pot of experience and ambition. I left Tatler full-time art directing and the building at the end of the last century, and in some ways that seemed appropriate. A decade and an era were over for me, and now it is time to turn off the lights for the building itself. All things must come to an end, even in Vogue House. You will see as you read through this book that there are themes that connect all of the magazines that existed within Vogue House. Tight budgets, a sense of entitlement, and restrictive practices are three of these. But another is a distinctly non-politically correct approach to office behaviour. I have not mentioned here every event and situation I've been told of, but suffice to say, Vogue House definitely had its fair share of employees who pushed the boundaries of acceptable work practices. Walking across Hanover Square, you couldn't help but look up at its windows and wonder who was in there and what they were up to. To many, it was the centre of fashion, glamour, taste and beauty, a place to aspire to work. To others, it was a temple to luxury, commercialisation, a symbol of privilege and wealth, a monument to nepotism, and to be avoided at all costs. All I can say is that I was employed based on my work, not my family, friends, or school. A South London boy who found a desk in the West End with a view of a world I knew nothing about. Vogue House had room for me. It was never easy, always challenging, demanding, and occasionally impossible. This book tells the story of Vogue House and the people who trod its floorboards in their own words, and also charts the history of magazine publishing in the UK over a period of technological innovation and social economic change. So pull up a chair, sit back, and relive the nostalgia, memories and tales of a lost time, entertainingly told by the people who made magazines that defined six decades of popular culture, fashion and lifestyle. Here are just two of those stories that I think sum up some of the reality of working within Vogue House. The first was told to me by Jeffrey Aquilina Ross. I was an army officer at Sandhurst, bored witless, and I brought myself out of the army. I returned to London and found myself unemployable, and a girlfriend said, "I've got you a job. You can't live in London without any money, so you're going to be one of the waiters at the Contented Soul in South Kensington." She didn't tell me it was a fish and chip shop, but it was great fun, as all of the waiters and waitresses wanted to be actors, as did I. One day, I was serving a table of eight charming people, whom I was getting on with very well, and they said, "What are you doing in a place like this?" I said that I would take any job to get out of there, and they said, "Why don't you become the men's fashion editor of Vogue?" I didn't know Vogue or anything about men's fashion, but I said that I'd love to. They said, "Write to Beatrix Miller, the editor," which I did. I was invited for an interview with her, and in the open plan office, she said, "Anyone ever heard of Jeffrey Aquilina Ross?" And eight people said, "Yes, we had dinner with him recently." But they didn't say I was the waiter. I got the job, and B. Miller gave me a career. The day I started, I finally found out where my office was and went to the third floor. It was a big room, and as I walked in, a tall girl said, "Are you Jeffrey?" And I said, "Yes." She said, "My name's Penny, and I think I'm your secretary. What do you want me to do?" I said, "Well, the room's empty. We had better order some furniture." She was the daughter of Lady Penelope Plowden, who was very well known in those days, and in no time I was sharing the office with Pamela Collin, who married Lord Harlech. Many girls then joined Vogue to marry a lord. Pamela got Harlech. Second story is by Daffy Jones, a photographer and also a contributor previously to this podcast. Daffy said this: "Mark Boxer took me to Lord's for the day to watch the cricket. Someone in Vogue House had organised a Fortnum's hamper with all sorts of delicious sandwiches and a bottle of Chablis. Mark had lots of ideas to discuss with me, but he also had a problem. The journalist, Vicky Woods, had negotiated for herself a company car as part of her salary package, a white Mini Metro. But Vicky was leaving and returning the car. Mark didn't want it to be generally known in the office that a company car was possible for anyone, but he also didn't want to lose it. So he asked, would I have the car? That question led to me meeting Miss Timms, who organised the handover of the car to me. I let my wife use it to do the school run." I hope you enjoyed that little kind of tangential element of the podcast. If you did, as I said, the book's on sale now. So I've got a busy couple of weeks with the launch of that book and promoting it. And as I said, if you can make it along to Hatch Art on Thursday, the 25th of April, then I'd love to see you there. Come up to me and say, I'm a podcast listener. That would be great. Anyway, I'm busy. I'm sure you're busy. What we're all going to do is take care.